Blog Talk Radio.
Warning. You are about to leave your comfort zone. Beyond the teachers. Beyond the gurus. Beyond duality. Ever beyond.
Good evening and welcome to Ever Beyond. Tonight I will be speaking with Brian Internacia, all the way from Montreal, Canada. Brian is a game designer and artist, and also with the interest in esoterics. And what we'll be talking about is what lies underneath, behind, inside the core of the gamer. Welcome, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you, JP. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, you're very, very welcome. It's, I'm sure this is going to be a very, very interesting conversation on lots of different levels. So, do you want to, first of all, sort of introduce yourself to the audience and let us know where your kind of where your background's in terms of gaming and in esoterics as well.
Right. Well, I've been playing video games since I'm 5 years old, actually. I started on the Atari and the Coleco and television. And I was very intrigued by the graphics and the colors and stuff like kids. But since the age of four, I've been drawing all sorts of stuff, from comic book stuff to whatever I would see, you know, for kids or for grown-ups. It didn't really matter. I would just draw. And so as I was growing up, I was somebody that was very interested in, you know, anything that was science fiction, stuff that's very creative and imaginative, worlds that don't exist within this construct.
Mm-hmm.
And being very fascinated by these worlds that these creators would bring about, I basically, through the years growing up, I launched myself in many fields trying to break in, you know, through comic books as a comic artist. That didn't work out for me because it was very excessive in terms of the amount of hours you have to put into drawing these things. So then I started to shift more towards video games. And then when I hit about the age of, about 13, 15 years old, I had started working on a certain video game of my own, being inspired by games like Mortal Kombat, Street Fighter. And I wanted to basically, you know, prove the world I can, you know, as a kid, I can create something just as cool as everybody else out there. And so that's pretty much where my background lies, is that I was, you know, an artist at a young age. Started going to arcades, playing on the coin-op machines, you know, wasting my parents' money in the machines to stay there all day and do nothing else. I'd be in school, and all I would do is just draw all day and not really focus on my studies, which that did pose a problem for me growing up, because later on trying to get into the industry, I didn't really have my high school, so I had to go back, finish my high school. Then I went to school for that trade so I could learn and master new techniques and softwares that were up to date, which I was not aware of. And that's pretty much where it kicked off, where I started, you know, really driving to get into the game industry and hopefully get a chance at making any kind of game, regardless if it was popular or not, just because I'm passionate about creativity. So I started doing, you know, pixel graphics, you know, pixel for pixel animation, to all the way to 3D stuff, you know, that's very well known today. And so through that process, that's what brought me to where I am today in my life as a designer, is that I ended up basically focusing on creating game design documents that would allow the artists, the sound designers, and programmers to create worlds that were really out far-reaching, you know, stuff all the way from on-world stuff to off-world stuff. So that's pretty much it.
Wow. So, Brian, can you tell us a little bit about the process of making a game? I mean, there are many different layers and people involved. So, say we'll start, if we were to start with, I've got an idea for a game. What are the different stages and processes involved from that point of thinking, I've got an idea for a game, to the fact, to the release of that game, for instance, it's being put on on a world server or on a shelf, because there are online games as well. Games that you don't actually have to install on your PC. They run on the web, don't they?
Yes, such as like World of Warcraft, which is kind of half and half. Uh-huh. But yeah, there are games like Facebook has a lot of social games, which is strictly server side that you don't even have to install anything.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what goes into the process of making games through the years. I mean, I've got like 20 years experience in the field as a freelancer.
Mm.
And the reason why I'm a freelancer is because I get to jump from contract to contract and I can actually choose for myself what I want to work on. I'm not limited to whatever project that the company gives me. So that allows me to express myself a lot easier because I'm not confined to limitations that they provide me. I can confine myself to my own limitations.
Mm.
And basically what goes into the process of gaming with the recipe that I've developed through the years and what I've been teaching is you basically, you know, there's many ways of making a game, but the fundamental basics that require a lot of effort and a lot of time is the research. You have an idea, but, you know, you got to take into consideration that everybody has ideas. Yeah. And so you have to figure out something that's going to actually be doable at the same time being something that people are going to want to invest in and say, oh, right, this is going to make money because that's how they think, right?
Mm.
So I had to basically explore video games as a gamer, play all the titles out there, regardless if it was Barbie or Barney or Street Fighter or Combat. I really had to stretch out my horizons because otherwise I would limit myself to what is really being done. And so through that process, I started to pick up on little techniques on how they would do things, just anywhere from reading through GamePro magazines, for example, which was very popular at the time, in dissecting how Mortal Kombat is put together, all the way to, you know, how they would do the Zelda series on the SNES and on the NES console, which is Nintendo Entertainment Systems. And so through that process, what it allowed me to discover is basically the techniques that I want to bring to the table with my talent and my limitations. But at the same time, because of that gaming experience, I knew for myself what I would want to play if I was a gamer and not the other way around, where I'm trying to create something to convince people to, you know, or dictate to them, this is what you're going to play.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to create something that people like me are going to want to enjoy, because if I think it sucks, then why am I doing it?
Yeah, exactly.
And so that was one of the angles that really helped me flesh out my talent and my abilities to diversify myself, diversify the teams I would work with. And through the analysis of the video games, at one point I got so in tune with the process that I could just basically turn on any video game, sit there for about 5-10 minutes and figure out how they did it. And then I'd go about and do it in my own way for the limitations of my abilities, because obviously I'm not a 130-man team. I'm a one dude, right?
Mm.
So basically what I would do is I would go from coming up with an idea. Then once the idea was, you know, like a short little brief synopsis or a little plot of where I want to take the project, the beginning, maybe not the middle, but the end. So at least I had an idea of the perspective I need to take this project to, so that whoever's working on it, everybody's on the same level.
Mm.
I was somebody that discovered that through the process of gaming, what hurts a lot of teams, and which is something they've corrected by now, obviously, is that everybody has to be involved in the process, even if it's just a writer or if it's just a programmer. If the people are actually in the same room when there are meetings for creative ideas to be developed and to, you know, throw things around and say this works, this doesn't work, you can get everybody's potential in one room, and then that becomes one consciousness that develops into itself as being one entity, because where you're weak, you can find somebody that can strengthen you by doing it for you or helping you elevate your abilities by teaching you how to do certain things. Or they would, you know, have programmers that could have certain ways that they want to put something together, and they could tell you, well, with the hardware and the software we got, these are the limitations, so yes, this can be done, or no, this cannot be done. This can range anywhere from color palettes for limitations of colors in a game because of the memory to, for example, you know, the size of the video game versus how long it'll take to make it. And so I started getting very familiar with the realistic approach of developing games that are not too big, but that the content that's in there is very solid and people can say, I had a beautiful experience And so what I would do is I would sit down and I would just basically draw characters. This is my way to express myself and to really dig into the idea, because I'm a very visual person.
Mm.
I'm very good as a motivational speaker for the teams, but sometimes to speak words, it's not enough. You really need to draw out some elements so that people can really understand the angle you want to take it, anywhere from camera shots to character design to the world. And so what I would do is I would tell the team, like, okay, we got the fundamental idea of the story, where we want to go with it, but it's not set in stone. And that's very good not to do that, because that allows for people to really push themselves and say, well, I can contribute to this because I thought this could really be amazing. You know, and then you look at it, and if you think it'll work and they can sell their idea and convince you that it belongs in the game, then you focus on that as being an extra element that's brought in to amplify the quality of the game experience. And so once we had the drawings laid out, from the worlds, from the color palettes, to characters, to whatever, then we'd actually go back to the artist ourselves, and we'd sit down with the writers, and we'd decide, okay, well, what's the history of this character? You know, why is he like this, and why would he want to do this to begin with? I mean, is he wasting his time? Is he, you know, really investing himself because he lost something? We'd really go deep into the character history, just because even though we might not be able to put everything into the game, if we learn to harness our characters to the point where we feel we are the character, then regardless on the amount of information we give, the idea works, because people are like, whoa, this character is really awesome. And they don't fully understand why, but because we did all this background work, it really supports and strengthens the character's history. Therefore, it strengthens the storyline, and it pushes the story in a progressive manner, rather than hitting, you know, bumps in the road where you're like, okay, this part sucks. Why are we doing this? And so basically from that process, from the writer, then we'd go back to the drawing boards, and then we'd, you know, rework the ideas, because we'd have even better ideas to make the characters even more believable. And then at one point, we'd end up with a world that worked. And then it was like, okay, we have everything on paper. Now that the paperwork is done, which is the tedious process, now let's go have some fun and let's do the grunt work. Let's get the graphics out. Let's provide this to the programmers. Let's get them to work on the game engine. And another thing that's very good to point out is when you're developing a video game, you're always stuck with limitations, and you have to be able to push those limitations to such a point that if you look at certain titles out there, you're like, wow, I can't believe they pulled that off on that console. Well, that's because they master the hardware and the software. And to be able to do that with your visuals and your sound and everything, you need to have programmers that understand the technology, because the technology is always giving you limitations. And if you're able to counteract that through collaboration of effort and, you know, minds that come together to really figure out, well, where could we go corners and still get the same effect, you get a better result in the end, and you get a more satisfying experience, and then you get gamers that want to come back and buy your product again, because they're like, these guys know what they're doing. Mm. And so basically that was the recipe that I developed. It started from the drawing board to the story, to then back to the drawing board, and then hand everything over to the programmers, so once they have all that, as they're building the tools, they can see where we want to take it, and then they see how they have to code it so that the engine can handle at least half of what we're asking for, if not all. So basically,
right. So
that's my recipe.
So let's just explain a couple of things. I happen to know what an engine is. Can you explain to our audience who may or may not understand programming or gaming what an engine is and where they came from?
Okay, well, an engine, I'm going to go off of what I know, because, I mean, I'm no programmer. I've played around with some languages, you know, very basic languages in the past, like Pascal and you know, HTML and all that kind of stuff. And having worked with very solid programmers in assembler language or C++, you basically end up finding out that there are multitudes of ways to actually create an engine. And the engine, what it is at its fundamental base, is it's the heart of what runs the entire software, the entire program. It's a program. And so what you're doing is you're building tools for the artists and the programmers to be able to assemble these as modules. And these modules, once they are all linked together, they can give you a final output, which is the product itself. So you can have a sound module, so they'll actually develop technology that can play, you know, sound through input and output, depending on what the game is. to basically developing tools for the artist to be able to import their graphics, rather, you know, regardless if it's 2D or 3D graphics, 3D models, animation, you know, and then there's other modules like physics. So basically, it's basically all these little nuggets that you end up plugging together into one core. And what that core is very simple. It's basically something that's able to draw on screen what you are sending to the video card. Mm-hmm. And so basically the software communicates with the video card at all times, and it's what allows you to have an image on screen. So this one little nugget is like the heart of a human being, if you will. And then all the different body parts are all the different modules that allow the team to piece together the software, so then once they reach the final output, they compile the entire engine, because the engine is not just one thing, it's the entire thing.
Yeah.
They basically bring it into one solid file that is basically an application, an executable. Yes, you will have folders and subfolders and stuff like this, because it holds the content, all depending how the programmers piece this software together. But at the fundamental basics, that's what the core is. A game engine is an engine that is able to draw on screen the graphics for you and output sound, and also respond to controls or key on a keyboard or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So all these together is an engine. So
yeah.
You can have that full engine, but however, let's not forget that you can have programmers that are very versatile in their experience and how they piece these things together, that these modules can be actually taken in or taken out of the product. Meaning, if you're developing a tool for sound, that's a sound engine. If you're developing a tool to draw 3D polygons or just simple sprites, which is the old classic, you know, side-scroll games like Mario, where it's like a 2D image that's just animated frame by frame, then you have a graphics engine. So it's a whole bunch of little mini engines that end up giving you one solid engine that in the end you have a playable game.
Thank you. So when I just want to say the first computer game that I experienced was in the 1980s. I used to work in university and worked in the computer center. And there was a moment when the entire center shut down, basically, because everybody was playing this game.
Okay.
You know, all the programmers, you know, nobody was doing any real work. We were all playing this game. And it was called Adventure. And the way it was written in a language called Fortran. Now, if you understand computer languages, Fortran is not a gaming language. It's a language designed to translate mathematical formulas. Fortran programs, for instance, are things that calculate the trajectory of missiles, the thing getting you to the moon and back, writing... weather controlling software or weather forecasting data software on supercomputers. That's all Fortran. But it was not meant to handle text, and it certainly wasn't meant to be an interactive text handler. So, it was, again, you know, you're talking about the engine. The way they got Fortran to do these things, they had to write their own library. And basically, you spoke to them. This game, you know, the first thing it says, you know, is you look around and you know, you're in a cave, and you can go north, south, east, or west, up and down, you go into these different areas like little mazes or rooms that you can't get into or out of unless you say a magic word and things like that. It was a bit like what they call it, Dungeons and Dragons, this game that people play in their living rooms as an interactive role-playing game. Adventure was the first kind of attempt at a computer world, as a world inside a game, a virtual world, as you'd say. So it's quite amazing to go from that, which was run on these like enormous fridge-sized computers, to something that everybody's got. You know, they're even being played on. You could probably get Adventure now on an iPhone app or something like that. Now you've got full interaction. You've got you've probably got virtual reality glasses and headphones that absolutely immerse you into a world. Do you get that nowadays?
Very much so.
Yeah. I mean, it's all very much like a complete immersion nowadays, rather than sort of it being sort of green letters on a screen as it was then. That was about 1983, 82, 83, that sort of thing was going on. So, what is it, 20 years now? Nearly 20 years.
Yep. Yeah, they've pushed that. I mean, you look
at... No, 30, nearly 30 years. That's still quite a leap for technology. Anyway, cool.
Yeah, they've pushed that in so many games now. I mean, you got games, you know, going from, like, anywhere, well, like, massive multiplayer online games, like World of Warcraft, which is, you know, globally known, has basically all those features you were talking about before set in different contexts, but... You know, I mean, you can have inventories now where you'll be, you know, skinning animals to get, you know, their leather so that you can make armor with it, and then you can sell it at an auction house, and then you can sell it for gold. You can get that currency back to make profit, and then whoever's wearing that armor knows it was made by you, you know, and it's represented by the name of your character. And then they have things, you know, where, like, you can have the chat, which is integrated in there, all the way to microphone communication with people if you're doing raids in towns. So, I mean, they've really pushed the envelope on these concepts with 3D games.
Yeah, and they're using all the aspects. I mean, for instance, we and our friends regularly use Skype to have conference calls, but people use these within a game, so you can have a team of players.
Yep.
Who don't appear to be a team. They can be all sorts of different kind of characters, couldn't they? But they're all working for the same. So in a way, you could say that that's like a soul to a personality expression sort of relationship, which is where I wanted, where we were originally talking about where this conversation was going to go, which is like, what's the soul? You know, in terms of the truth, as we've discovered it, you know, through our research with Project Camelot and with Rebecca and with all these truth speakers, who give, you know, everybody has their own piece of the puzzle, and you know, there are so many people now with bits of puzzle. It's getting to be a very exciting time. People are coming along and bringing huge chunks of the puzzle, and it's becoming more and more clear. And in the gaming world, is there anything? Do you think the gaming world has an extra part to add to this puzzle that we're discovering, or do you think that it's a channel, a route, a vector for expression of this truth to the people?
I think it's pretty much both. I mean, there's so many titles out there. If I was to take myself, for example, having worked on video games and seeing what, you know, is being exposed in movies, back then you used to inspire, you know, your ideas from movies or novels you would read and whatnot. And now it's like the other way around. They're starting to look at the video games and say, whoa, the video games, you know, they have something that's just as solid as what you'll find in a novel, because you're not sitting in front of the computer or in front of the game console for 2 hours. And watch the movie and it's over. It's like a novel. You can play 80 hours of a video game like the Final Fantasy franchise, where there's minimum 80 hours of gameplay, and it's not just running around, you know, just being rampant and doing everything and nothing. It's like there's actually elements that are integrated in there that make you feel that you're expressing yourself, because you can relate to the characters. They build the stories of these characters to reflect things that people could have potentially experienced in life. Anywhere from, you know, loss of family members, and then seeing the tragic cinematics that you see the character, you know, sad and hurt, and that's what made him so evil, or actually be a benevolent but even stronger because he actually experienced these things and is trying to help others get through it. I mean, there are so many layers of truth in what reflects real personalities in the world through, you know, everybody, that the characters can be expressing anything from a personal point of view to an actually hidden truth message that has to do with stuff that is historical facts or technologies being developed as we speak that are not known to the mass public, that they keep hidden. Yet these corporations, they have access to these people that because these people are obviously the ones funding these projects, okay? I mean, you have Uncle Sam that's supporting Tom Clancy and stuff like that, in my opinion. I mean, I have no proof of that. But when you see things like Tom Clancy's game, you know, where it's like End War, I mean, and you play the video game and you realize, you know, it's potentially World War III in Europe and stuff like this where it all started. I mean, there's so many underlying truths and things like this that people can relate to these games on so many different facets. And this is what really makes people addicted to these games without them necessarily knowing why. They find these things very intriguing and very interesting. But what they're actually learning in the process is they're being fed little crumbs of the truth through this twisted metaphor or through this character's personality. And some people, you know, resonate with that very deeply because they're like, well, man, I so understand that guy because what he just went through, man, like this happened to me. And they did it so well because this character really lives up to what that expression would be. To, you know, things where they're throwing in symbolism in certain games where the textures will be mapped in specific patterns to represent the one eye from the dollar bill. Or things like in Gears of War, I played Gears of War through, you know, in and out. And in Gears of War 2, there's one thing that really struck me when I was near the end of the game. When you're underground in Inner Earth, okay, you end up going through the staircase that the actual structure that builds around the staircase you're going to go through is an exact representation of the Tower of Babel. So you have a lot of content in there that these creators are embedding into the games because, in my opinion, it's one of two things. Either they're, you know, disinformation that they're putting in there because it fits with the game that they're making, and they're not necessarily doing it purposely to hurt or disinform people, but it just fits with the storyline and whatnot. To certain designers like Cliff Bleszinski, which is the creator of Gears of War at Epic Games, which I personally think, from my experience, you know, in seeing this guy go about creating his games from Unreal all the way to Gears of War, this guy is really trying to get some truth out about what the military does and the way that people are brainwashed to follow a certain order of dictatorship to annihilate a race called the Locust. And when you find out who the Locusts are, you find out they live in Inner Earth. So this guy has obviously done his homework and a lot of research, through 10 years of research, to create this video game title. And it's no kidding why it's like one of the top-selling franchises in the world, because people, on a cellular level, and this is my opinion, on a cellular level, they are resonating with it because of potentially past lives and experiences they may have had or access to information they already do have and they are aware of, and they're starting to come together and realize, oh my God, this guy, like, he's exposing truth. And he's not necessarily lying about it. He's just changing it in a metaphoric way so that the companies allow him to release his title so he can give us the information, but he can't get pointed at for being a whistleblower.
Yeah.
And this allows him to push his career further and further. And this guy's, our, you know, he's my age. He's in his early 30s. So I think he's about 35. So it's like you got a lot of designers out there that they don't do games for, you know, the lack of a better term, wasting their time because they're too lazy to get a real job. There are some that have that thinking. But today, games are so demanding, just like any other field, and it requires so much effort and investment of your own time. People will go as far as what Jordan Maxwell has done, is like invest his entire life in the, you know, esoteric stuff. And you look at guys like Cliff Bleszinski, who's done the same thing, and he expresses it through the making of his game. He's lost his girlfriend on and off because he's so dedicated to put this content into the games and making it the most badass video game that he can. And a thing that, a quote that he said in his book that I thought really struck me home was, he was breathing life into the game with his team. And so that, to me, is an underlying message telling you, you should look deeper into the game because there's a lot more truth to it than you really think there is. And so this is things I've observed, Jim. I mean, growing up, since I'm like 5 years old, games have been doing this since the dawn of time.
Right. Well, let's talk about the truth within games. And again, we're getting to the point when we're going to take it beyond.
Right.
And that is, which truths, which I've been thinking about different ways of approaching this. I mean, for instance, we could say, all right, if I give you a list of things in the, for instance, Camelot world, that are taken as a kind of basis of the big picture. You know what I'm saying? So, for instance, bases on the moon.
Yes.
There are games that have that. Bases on Mars.
Yes.
Colonizing
planets. Like
colonization of other planets. How about the Nazi infiltration into the CIA? Any games with that in?
Almost every Call of Duty video game has to do with World War II.
Right.
And if there's one thing that I find that they underline in those Call of Duty games is the whole fascist idea of how basically the world is run through fascism because of these corporations and how they use war to, you know, get their system going and push their agenda through and brainwash these soldiers to go and fight the enemy, where the enemy might not even be the enemy. They're told they're the enemy and they're brainwashed to believe they are. And on the other end, they're taught the same thing. So, you know, it's this propaganda that keeps feeding the mind and makes, you know, people basically crippled the truth because they're so brainwashed, they can't see truth from lies. So to them, whatever you tell them, they're basically, they're shaped into being that way so that they don't question it. And
so you'd say that there are, you'd say that there are people who are telling us the truth about these processes. I mean, for instance, there's MK Ultra as well, and you know, the propaganda machine, which started out as propaganda, became public relations and all of these things. And these things are illustrated to people. Are they illustrated in a clear way that people are able to actually see what they are, or you know what I'm saying? It's like when you're saying, you know, I see. This game is showing that people were propagandized on one side and propagandized on the other. And it's possible that people who are playing this game will see that game being played. If you
believe it or not, there's a lot of gamers that I've seen that actually don't even see it. A lot of them just play the game and the only thing they see is, oh, it's a cool game, I can't wait for the next one.
Yeah.
A lot of them are asleep and they're not waking up. They're not noticing the truth that's being thrown in their face because they're so dumbed down. They're so, and it might not be a factor of being dumbed down. It's like they're so immunized to it because they've been growing up watching these movies and these things since they're kids. So to them, it's norm. It's like, oh, the old same cliches, the same stories coming back, when they're not actually looking deeper into it to find out, wait a minute, are they actually doing this because they're trying to tell us something?
Yeah. So that sometimes might work as a countermeasure, that it's they're putting they see it as, oh, it's just a fiction,
right?
And that's the old plausible deniability. I mean, and in that way, the game producers can justify that to the corporations that they're working for. Well, it's just a game, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, the fact that it might contain classified information is beyond here and there. It's just this guy's imagination, wasn't it? Yeah.
So, I can take a game as an example for what you're basically asking, but taking it beyond. If you look at games like, well, the trilogy, I mean, there's more than the trilogy now. They've actually, you know, gone to Halo Reach. But if you just look at the first Halo trilogy that was created, you know, the writer was, and I've watched the making of it, and a lot of people have also, because you buy the collector edition and whatnot. And, you know, the writer, what he would do is he'd lock himself into a room for weeks and for months. And nobody was allowed to go into his office to find out what he's doing and what he's coming up with. And then you start to realize, okay, this guy's actually doing research. That's what it is. Because when you look at what the soldiers are, Master Chief himself, the character you play with, he's an augmented human. You know, he's a Spartan. That's one. There's one piece of information. They're called the Spartans.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Spartan 2, Spartan 3, and I think they're like a Spartan 4 or something like that. And the thing that I find is so beautiful about Halo is there is so much truth in there, just twisted just enough so that the video game can be released, that if people took the time to sit back and reanalyze Halo, they will find out that we're talking about, in Stargate, they call them the Asgard, okay?
Yeah.
The ones that look like greys.
Yeah.
They have the, I can't remember the name of the race, but Cynthia Crawford sculpted this on, in her, her mugshots. And this race is actually in the Halo trilogy, and they're considered to be what we call the elites. So you have the elites, then you have the Covenant. The Covenant, we've all heard of the Covenant. And then there's, in there, there's these little imps. But those imps, if you take off all the armor, you're like, oh my God, those are the 4-foot-tall aliens, the little gray aliens, you know, the EVEs. So it's like...
Yeah.
Then you got the Covenants where, like, you know, they walk around like gargoyles, if you will, you know, where they have these dragon-like legs, and those are they're part of the elite. They're the ones that basically protect the elders that are trying to activate the Halo rings. Now, these Halo rings, they're actually worlds that you can go on to, but they're artificially created by these very old ancestral races that no longer exist, that were wiped out when they activated the rings. Now, if you look at what these rings could actually reflect, they could reflect dimensions, different worlds, different realities. And these races are all embedded in there, and there's not one race in the Halo series that doesn't look like a race that we've been exposed to, whether it be Arcturian, whether it be Greys, whether it be Nephilim, they're all in there. And that's what's beautiful about it, is that they found a way to take the humans as basically the bait, if you will, to protect Earth from annihilation, from, here's the fear-mongering part of it, where these elites are trying to annihilate the Earth and enslave all of humanity. And then you have these Spartans, which with his John Spartan, the Master Chief, he's like a second or third generation Spartan, and where all this MK Ultra and Project Talon stuff comes in this storyline, is these children are taken when they're 6 years old from their families. Their families are mentally reprogrammed with histories that are false histories, so they don't even remember they even had this child, or if they are to remember about this child, the child is replaced by a clone that soon deteriorates and dies in a few years after they've had it. And so, you know, you take John Spartan, which basically later on becomes Master Chief, and him, he's the most badass one because he's seen so much suffering and so much destruction because of dictatorship and fascism that at this point he has no room for pity. It's like, okay, regardless if it's fascism or not, I'm the last hope of humanity, and I'm going to do this with the artificial AI, which right now, you know, it escapes my mind what the name of the girl is, but it's an artificial program that is put into a little chip that he plugs into his helmet, and he has constant conscious information transmitted to him from this being, and back and forth, him, you know, finding certain things. She sends him on missions, go locate this thing to activate the rings. Well, activate the rings. If we look at the 7 Halo rings, and we're talking about, you know, let's say 12 or 15 Stargates, all this content starts to mesh together. And so basically you realize that Halo has a lot of truth. It's just not the entire truth. It's like the Obi-Wan Kenobi syndrome. He'll give you half the truth now and the other half later when you find out your father's Darth Vader and you might be able to cope with it.
Yeah, because a lot of it is about what you can or cannot accept as a reality. I mean, considering the reality that... you and I and our friends speak of a lot, you know, when it's a completely separate reality from your everyday X Factor, Britain, stroke America, stroke Canada's Got Talent, etc. Big Brother kind of TV soap opera consciousness. We're so far away from that. And what these games are, you're saying, is that they may have an influence on the children of those people, at least to kind of undumb them.
Yes.
Undumb them up.
Yes, basically wake up what I call the sleeples. And so I find that it's a very good term. Richard Rao actually really likes that one when I use it. And so, yeah, totally. I think that a lot of these game designers are part of the consciousness awakening. They are like us. They are sick and tired of being in a system of control, seeing their families being dumbed down, their own children, their own brothers and friends. And so because they are gifted with abilities through programming or through design or, you know, art or storytelling, they come together and they take specific unique people that can bring something really fresh to the table to benefit that team, to get that idea across so far so that they will hopefully in the end win their point over that, hey, we're waking up the masses and you can't touch us because we're not telling them it's truth. We're just hiding it in there and then we're letting them figure it out and wake up on their own.
That's
it allows them to make sequels and trilogies and quadrologies and all these things.
Yes. Yes. So that's really the, I mean, in a way that we're talking about a kind of a secret resistance that is beneath the surface of the corporate world because they're working through the corporations, but working to express certain truths into essentially our next generation. But we were talking, won't have 100% success in getting this this information across. A lot of sleeples, a lot of sleeple might still be asleep after this. But how? I mean, is it? Do you think there's a possible way we could gauge the effect that that's having? Is there a kind of a metric we can find that will say yes? Certainly, this is waking people up.
That's a very good question. I think that when I look at video games now, the recent titles, what seems to wake people up that I've taken notice of is the story itself has to be very human. You have to be able to emotionally relate to it. If you can get these people to connect to what you're actually throwing at them, and actually try to question, like, wow, man, like this is amazing technology. Like, oh, man, I'm sure they're making this stuff right now. Just putting that doubt in their mind is sometimes enough to push them over the edge, to go outside the box and find out for themselves because they are so inspired by what they've seen visually or auditively or through story that the emotion takes over and it becomes like a drive that they want to know more, and they're like talking with their friends, and word of mouth is the most cancerous thing I find because that's what's beautiful about it. It doesn't cost you anything to tell someone something. It's up to them to believe it or not. But so long as you've passed on the message, as long as they're sitting there and they're questioning it, whether they believe it or not, it's enough to spark that little thing inside of them to make them wake up just that much more.
Yes. What is it? Each one teach one?
Yes.
Spread the news, spread the ideas. That's a marvelous thing.
A game I'd like to bring up that I just recently finished, because I'm a very hardcore fan of it, is the God of War series.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the gore and, you know, the dismemberment and all the violence, if you look beyond all of that, what is very beautiful about it is, you know, I'm sorry if I'm going to be spoiling some, so for some people I'm going to try and be as subtle about it as possible.
Spoiler alert.
Yes. Kratos is a Spartan. He rose to be the highest ranking general of his army, and long story short, he becomes the god of war, and then the whole story is taken to the end of the third one, where he's taking on the gods of Olympus and all the titans that rule the earth. And in the storyline, all the gods and all the titans are evil, every single last one of them, including Zeus. And so what happens is, what allows him to overcome and to defeat them all, to basically take all the power that they withheld from mankind, okay, so we can look at this from a corporate standpoint, fascist standpoint, he takes all the power from the gods by killing every single one of them, kills every single titan, And once he retrieves all that power, he gives it back to humanity. But what is that underlying key element that allowed him to actually destroy gods and be the first man to be able to overthrow a god and a titan? Is that one element called hope. Because he believed so much in himself to be able to do this and actually end his revenge by basically finding inner peace and forgiving himself for what he's done, he was able to basically become so powerful that even the gods feared him, and that's how he wins them over and defeats them, is because hope was that one little spark of belief in him that gave him that extra push to say, it's enough. It's time that mankind takes back their power, because this world belongs to them. It is not you to dictate to them how to live their lives. And that, I thought, was very powerful. And that's an ingredient in the trilogy that makes the whole story work, regardless if people are into mythology or not.
And just that's the intent behind his actions.
Right, exactly. And if you look at people today, waking up by the masses, it's all about intent. Because intent and thoughts put together, I find, drives people and pushes them to boundaries they've never thought capable of before, because they're no longer in fear to go there.
Mm. Exactly. So, fearlessly moving on.
Yes.
Beyond and beyond and beyond. What do you think the gaming world hasn't yet incorporated, but do you think maybe the next step? I mean, let me just qualify this in that we, at the moment, seem to be waking up in an exponential way. So, for instance, you know, you could, 10 years ago, you could write a book and it was published on the circuit and it would be news to people. 5 years ago, you could maybe make a film or a TV documentary, you know, which has got a cycle of, I mean, for instance, a book, the cycle of learning to write, starting to write a book and getting it published, and maybe that might be about a year or so. And then you might have make a video film, and that might take you, you know, 6 months or something like that. But the trouble is that the spread of information is getting faster and faster. So now, here, October 2010, we're now looking at a point where almost immediately you have an idea that it's now in the public consciousness.
Right.
Almost immediately. The cycle is so short that I'm sure that there'll come a time when we won't actually be able to publish anything faster than everybody will already know. It'll, you know, the level of telepathy will go up, and people's awakening will go up. I don't think we're quite there, because I think that's what they say at the end of the day, we're all one. I think that's the deep meaning behind that. But first of all, where does a game fit in that cycle? You know, there's a book, there's a film. You know, James Campbell took 12 years to make Avatar, but you know, that's a long cycle. You know, although amazingly, it did drop in and slot in exactly at the right place at the right time for people to have certain new understandings about the way the soul and personality work. You know, the driver of the vehicle and the vehicle itself.
Well, if I was to look at what's being done with Kinect, which is a new technology developed by Microsoft that they're basically raving about, is going to be allowing players to play video games without holding a remote control, that their body will be the remote control, because the camera is actually two lenses that read a certain way. I'm not too sure how the technology works, but programmers have explained to me that much, that it's actually two lenses that scan the area that you're playing in. And so depending on how the software is built, meaning the video game, the people will be able to be the avatar. Now, that is actually coming now because it's actually being produced. But however, one element I think that is missing to bring the games beyond, you know, what has been done for decades, is that one element of spirituality, which is, that's what's lacking in video games. They're so busy throwing in hate mongering and fear mongering that they've totally sidewiped on the spirituality. So if I look at Kinect, and you're actually interacting in real time yourself with the video game, imagine a video game that would actually teach you about consciousness, and you have to harness your powers, but now you're actually doing this physically. You're interacting with the game. You're learning to meditate and to go within. Not only is the game going to give you a really cool experience, but consciously people will evolve a lot faster because they're going to actually start to develop meditation for real without even noticing it. And next thing you know, they're going to be like, whoa, man, I'm so much more astute. I'm so much more aware of stuff. I'm so much more relaxed and within myself as one being. I think if they can throw games in that direction and bring in the element of spirituality and this Kinect technology and so on, you're going to create a virtual world that is going to be almost a reflection of the construct of what you're capable of doing now if you really wanted to put your efforts into the benevolent aspect of it. And I think that that's what's harming, you know, these people from waking up. That's what's slowing down the process of waking them up through the games, is they're missing that spiritual awakening.
Yeah. Well,
and I think that's the element that's missing.
It's easier to sell hate than it is to sell love. It always has been. It's the same with newspapers. It's easy to sell gossip and negativity than it is to sell positive news and things like that. In fact, we have a newspaper in Britain. It's a very small one. It's got a really low circulation. It's only about 10 pages, and it's positive news, you know. And in a way, it's a really sad state of affairs that, you know, positive news only makes up like a real scrapling of a rag, whereas, you know, they have daily papers that are published with hundreds of pages. So one of the things that I was thinking about while you were saying that is, are there any games that explore the idea of karma as it expresses through the way reality... you were talking about when you were in this position as a player in the game, that right. You have the chance to save humanity. So say the object of the game was to eliminate the opposition, but the way that you eliminate them and the intent that you eliminate them with has an effect on future events in the game. Does that ever happen? Is there a kind of, or could this be an avenue for further game design? Because, for instance, if you you might have your assailant, your enemy, and you catch up with the enemy, and you've got a choice of different weapons or ways of killing this person.
Right.
And some are more or less merciful.
Yes.
At that point, there is a metric. You know, you're judging how cruel or how honorable you're being as the player.
Right.
Does that ever get taken into account during, you know, in the point, for instance, awarding points, or in the future action of the game that you're in?
Well, there is one game that I have noticed where they've actually done this. I'm sure there's other games. Gears of War being the most obvious one, because when you're actually playing the game, you got different weapons you have, pistols, and you have one at the bayonet with a chainsaw. You can choose to cripple the guy by pounding at him 3 times or whatnot, depending on how many hits you have to hit him, and then he dies. Mm-hmm. Or you could take the chainsaw and just literally cut him in half immediately. So you can have something that's very mild, you know, death, or you can have extremely gory, excessive death. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the fear and the hate approach, they've really pushed it in that direction. But in terms of how you're going to be merciful on your opponent because you want to do more of an honorable kill, they really haven't explored that much, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
They really have a lack for that because, like you said, violence sells very much because that's the propaganda they've been feeding us since we're kids.
Yeah.
And so that's a thing, an avenue I think they should actually explore, because Gears of War has pulled it off on a violent aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see why massive multiplayer online games couldn't do that. Take Star Wars, for example. If there's an MMO of Star Wars, why wouldn't it be possible to have the Jedi that you're playing decide to either spare the guy's life and have him, you know, thrown, you know, in front of a tribunal and being trialed for whatever his crimes are, versus, you know, impaling a laser sword through his chest and
exactly.
killing him because
exactly.
he deserved it.
Exactly. So,
yeah, I think that's something they have not explored.
That's interesting. Well, let's hope we see that in future games. It would be lovely to have a game of where you could truly play an avatar. You could truly be a spiritual warrior like Lao Tzu or the Buddha or Jesus or Muhammad, or you know, where you're actually going out and you're changing the world around you, and the way you change it is as important as the fact of changing it, because that sends it on a particular angle, a particular trajectory that will, at the point when it comes back down to Earth again, will have positive or negative consequences. I mean, for instance, if we look at the Catholic Church now and all this stuff, they're coming a cropper, you know, the Pope's being served writs for child abuse and for not reporting and all these things, and they're looking at the finances of the Queen and the Catholics, and again, it's all falling to pieces, and yes. And that's because of their intent at the beginning, mm-hmm. And we're now kind of, as far as that's concerned, we're now approaching the end of the day. And that it's a very interesting thing to look at. So currently, the gaming world hasn't caught up with that aspect.
No.
Not, okay.
World of Warcraft kind of explores certain things that could be seen as, good or bad decisions, because you can do things for other people. Like, for example, I'll build you an armor, and I'll have my friend, you know, in my guild, put, you know, some magic spells on it so that it could have magic attributes, and then that allows that person to have more chances of overcoming a certain quest because they're having difficulties struggling to defeat the adversary. In that approach, it's been done, but not to the level that we'd like to see.
Hmm. Okay, well, I've actually got a question from a member of the audience. This is Chris Vortex. This will round up nicely. You've got 2 minutes to do it, but if you want to carry on further after the show finishes, that people can download the archive, as you know. So the question is, in most games, there has to be a winner and a loser.
Yes.
For instance, in football, if you don't win, you get a draw or a loss. You know? But the thing is, it's in most concept, in most game concepts, there is the idea of winning.
Yeah.
But in the video game world, it's not so necessarily much about winning; it's about enduring. And figuring out and being quite good with your mind as well as with your finger skills and things like that. So just what I'd just like you to do is address that. See, are there any alternatives to winning, losing kind of things?
That's a really good question, actually. I'd say that there are... Okay, well, if I take Ubisoft, because I know people that work at Ubisoft, I will not name names because they've asked me to keep their names, you know, secret for obvious reasons, so they don't lose their jobs for saying this, but they're into what we call casual gaming. And the casual gaming is you got to make a video game that you can help the player get through the game so that in 30 hours it's finished and he can go off and spend money and buy a new one of the same company so they keep making profit.
Yeah.
So the idea behind the games today is really driven behind win, 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 you can't lose, and if you lose, well, just start over. And what they do to push you to continuously want to win so you can always keep ranting that you did it, is they give you endless lives. You have infinite continues or infinite lives. There's no more 3 or 4 continues and game over, start over from scratch, because that pisses people off and they don't want to play the game no more. And they're only seeing the money at the end of it. But the creators who are making the game, they're seeing it from the other point of view that we discussed during the show. So it's always about win, 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 and there is no happy medium.
So that's a very interesting thing.
and whatever that feeds. Now, I'd like to say good night to our live audience, and if you download the archive, we'll be able to you'll be able to get a few more minutes. But I imagine that Brian and I will be finishing that quite soon, unless we think of something interesting. So thank you. Thank you, everybody, for joining us, and we'll see you next week. That should be... that should be it. Blog Talk Radio. This is Ever Beyond on Blog Talk Radio. Well, it doesn't say anything. I think it's finished. Right, okay. Yes, the show is on, but not streaming. So, it's been a very interesting conversation, Brian.
Thank you, Jerry. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Is there anything that now pops up after the live session that you'd like to address? Any things like that? You thought, oh, I should have said that.
Well, the only thing that comes to mind is when I look at games, I think it would be fun if we can get enough of the, you know, of the powers that be or powers that were, depending on whose point of view we're looking at, if they would actually allow people to put the actual truths from their actual knowledge that they could actually contribute to the game industry in an honest approach, really feed the real information and allow them to disclose truth. Fine. If you don't want to give them the entire truth because you think it's too much to handle, at least be the ones to provide the information to these game creators to help them elevate the consciousness through gamers' experiences, because they're the ones that know what the heck is hidden. They're the ones holding it back. They're the best tool that we can have to actually allow these video games to flourish in an ever beyond way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's really the fundamental problem, is that these people that are involved are not fully being honest and coming forward to say, well, the heck with it. Death is just an illusion. We're all experiencing ourselves subjectively. Let's just help contribute to our consciousness. They're not seeing it that way. They're seeing it as a threat. And so this is the problem that I have with it, is these people that have the knowledge could help this change, but they're not willing to do it yet because they're still in fear.
Mm.
So that would be my take on it.
Brian Internacia, thank you very much. This has been Ever Beyond, Beyond Gaming. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Why don't I play this?